I want to tell you about a new podcast called Amuse News. Publishing multiple days a week, Amuse News is your source for food news, interviews from around the food world, and more. On the show, we'll be engaging with food storytellers, from chefs to advocates to people working in the field, and many more. Find Amuse News wherever you get your podcasts. Amuse News is a destination for everyone who's looking for a new, insightful look into the world of food.
This piece has been brought to you by Bonnie Plants. BonniePlants.com.
I'm Linda Palaccio, host of A Taste of the Past. You're listening to Heritage Radio Network, broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. If you like this program, visit heritageradionetwork.org for thousands more.
Okay, then. Yes, sirree. It's Monday. It's 12 o'clock, and it's time for Guess What? What's the name of my show again? Oh, yeah. What Doesn't Kill You? Food Industry Insights. I'm your host, Katie Kiefer. We're going to be talking in a few minutes with Sandy McLeod, who directed a fantastic documentary called Seeds of Time. But before we get to Sandy, we're going to talk first about my joys and sorrows. Now, I know that this week we have all been mourning the loss of the wonderful artist formerly known as Prince. I will not favor you with a karaoke version of Kiss, as I did last night at a friend's birthday party. But I know that we all share that terrible moment of sadness. And I can only say that I'm incredibly glad that I am not a rock and roll musician, because apparently this year someone's got the stink eye on them, because they'd be dropping like flies, man. It's really painful. All of my childhood or teenage and early life heroes are going away. Is it because I'm getting old? I think maybe. But it certainly was way before Prince's time, that's for sure. On the joyful side of things, I just want you all to know that black soldier flies are beginning to get much more attention as a livestock feed alternative. And if you happen to feel like scrolling back through my podcasts, 2 years ago, I did an episode about a company in South Africa that is breeding black soldier flies and feeding the larvae to poultry and to fish as an alternative to grains such as corn. Consider what a great burden that would be off of our food system. And just want to point out episode number 149, 2 years ago, finger on the pulse, baby. Huh? Finger on the pulse. I am there. In other news, I want to say I've completed the manuscript for a book, which has been joyfully accepted by my publisher, Reaction Books in the UK. My editor, Andy Smith, who was actually on this show a couple of weeks ago, it's not too much nepotism there, I promise. Anyway, Andy was on, and he read the manuscript, being my editor and everything, and he said, "What's your beef with the Chinese? You're always picking on the Chinese." Well, I'm not picking on the Chinese. I'm really actually full of admiration for how smart they are and how prescient and how well planned they are for the future and feeding their population, which seems to be something that our own country is failing to do in a kind of epic way. But to make my point, just in the past week, there were two major stories about Chinese acquisitions of agricultural assets. The first one was that China snapped up all four processing plants owned by the Brazilian meat processor Marfrig in Argentina. Four plants. That's a lot of processing power. And secondly, and this really surprised me, a Chinese consortium has purchased a 30,000 square mile parcel from the legendary Kidman Ranch, which is one of the largest single-owned private ranches in the world. I think it is something like 108,000 square miles. Anyway, this particular parcel is the size of Ireland, okay? And they are buying the cattle that go with it. And so what they had to do that, because last year the Chinese tried to buy the whole Kidman Ranch, and the government put the kibosh on that because it was part of it was quite close to a weapons testing area, if I remember correctly. And so then once the Australians kind of looked at that deal, they put the kibosh on that. And then they enacted some laws around allowing foreign nationals to buy up agricultural assets. Well, what the Chinese have done very cleverly is team up with an Australian firm. And so they're working with they have, you know, sort of a 60-40 split with an Australian firm, which is going to, quote unquote, help them run this this parcel of land along with all the cattle on it. But you know, the point is that we should all, like the Chinese, be thinking about future food security and, you know, managing our own assets better and protecting our own assets better from a country like China that has a very large projected population and is busily snapping up acquisitions all over the world. And so it's not that they're bad for doing it. It's they're smart for doing it. What's bad is when you're stupid enough to be the person who sells those agricultural assets. And remember, by the way, that they also recently purchased Syngenta, which is one of the top three seed companies in the world, a Swiss-owned firm with major presence here in the United States. So anyway, I'm saying that we should be enacting laws in our own country to protect our agricultural assets, just as other countries should be doing the same for themselves. But that ain't happening. And in the meantime, the Chinese are making hay while the sun shines. And then my next sort of I'm not sure whether this comes into a joy or a sorrow category. This was just a little squib that I noticed. The Japanese agricultural minister has announced plans to invest $36 million in the coming year into farm automation and developing robots to harvest in order to replace their aging farm labor resources because they don't have enough people to be able to take over farm labor, and they don't have the ready supply of immigrants that we do that they can mistreat, pay slave wages to, and otherwise abuse. So they are instead developing a mechanical workforce, which I think is, I guess, pretty smart. They even have one that can sort overripe peaches from just ripe peaches when they're harvesting. I think that's pretty cool. Only the Japanese would think of that. And then lastly, we'll finish up with just a moment of joy. Because even though, and this is a personal joy, even though I am totally covered with poison ivy, and I am not kidding you, I literally have it from my fingertips to my armpits, I had an amazing week of cutting brush up at my homestead in Rhode Island, and I now possess a 7-pound battery-operated chainsaw of my very own. And dainty and ladylike as only I can be, I will be affecting some major changes on my universe with this baby. So that is my joy for the week. And get the high five from Jack. And let's take a quick moment to do a sponsor drop. And then we'll be right back with Sandy McLeod, the director of Seeds of Time.
Help me find a way outside of the madness.
It's not just your garden. It's the way you live. And there's so much to know. But you have help. Bonnie Plants. Now with Bonnie's app, Homegrown, you can learn about veggie and herb varieties, track and record your garden with photos and notes, share on Facebook and Twitter, and so much more. How'd you ever grow without it? Get Homegrown with Bonnie Plants for iPhone and Android. The more you know, the better you can grow. With Bonnie.
One and only Dave Arnold brings the noise to Heritage Radio Network every Tuesday on Cooking Issues.
Coming to you live on the Heritage Radio Network from Roberta's Pizzeria in Bushwick, Brooklyn.
If the bomb was going to drop and you only had 15 minutes, which is like, I can make a sandwich in 15 minutes. He would be eating a sandwich.
I'd kiss my wife, make a sandwich.
If you believe that it's all about to be over, why eat healthy? I'm not a freaking Neanderthal. I like a tempered ice cream sandwich. But it's the only way to get around it if you're a party master, because you're going to wind up, like, your kitchen's going to fill with dishes. And
some people have commercial dishwashers in their house.
Who?
I've seen them.
Who?
I've seen them.
Who?
Really rich people.
For more mile-a-minute knowledge from Dave and the crew, listen to Cooking Issues, available on Heritage Radio Network, iTunes, and Stitcher.
Oh, man, I second that emotion. Dave Arnold is second to none. He is the bomb. Welcome to the show, Sandy McLeod. Let me just read your bio here. Sandy is an Academy Award nominated Independent filmmaker, her directorial debut was in music videos when she directed a series for VH1 called The 60s. Her next film was Doll Day Afternoon, a short film she directed for Saturday Night Live. She worked with Jordan Cronenweth and Jonathan Demme on Stop Making Sense. That was the Talking Heads, for those of you who are too young to remember. Then she conceptualized and directed a Talking Heads music video, which is now part of the permanent collection in New York's Museum of Modern Art. Her next project was an AIDS music video that she directed, also part of MoMA's permanent collection. She was the production designer of Swimming to Cambodia, a one-man show by the late lamented Spalding Gray, a fellow Rhode Islander. Further collaboration with Jonathan Demme resulted in a documentary called Haiti, Dreams of Democracy. She also directed an Academy Award-nominated short documentary called Asylum, a film about a Ghanaian woman who sought political asylum in the United States to escape female genital mutilation, and Seeds of Time is her first feature-length documentary film and the subject of our discussion today. Welcome to the show, Sandy. Thanks a lot for joining me.
Thanks. It's a pleasure to be here.
Now, Sandy, that's a fascinating segue that you made from doing music videos with the Talking Heads to doing, activist video or activist films such as the one about such as Asylum, for example, which must have been pretty painful to make. Tell me about that. How did you make that transition?
Well, it seems no matter how I live my life that I manage to dip my toes in some political snafuzzles. And even though I was doing Talking Heads music videos, there were a couple of them that actually were taken off the air by MTV because of things that we said in them.
Really?
They'd ask us to change a few things, and we didn't. And what we ended up doing was making them. There were little blurbs. They were little blurbs from Harper's Index. I don't know if you're familiar with that, but they have wonderful...
I don't think so.
Wonderful data on crazy things like how many machine guns do Americans own, and we would use those interstitially in the music video and one of them that I did. And what we did was we shortened them to the point where they were almost subliminal, hoping that people would then record the video and be able to look at it and read them more carefully. Which was acceptable to MTV at the time. So it seems like no matter what I do, what I did, I somehow managed to step in it. And so I figured, why not just go for it?
Yeah, right. Good for you. I think it's great. I mean, you have a wonderful CV. That's fantastic. And so tell me, how did you get involved in Seeds of Time?
I read an article in The New Yorker about Carrie Fowler. And agriculture... as we know it, is sort of depressing, and I'm very concerned about how we're going to be able to feed ourselves in the future because of the way we're farming. And
right.
When I read about Carrie, I never realized the loss of diversity that we have suffered mm-hmm. in agriculture. I never realized how profound that was. But I was really impressed by the fact that here was a sort of catastrophic thing that had been happening, and one person saw it and brought it to worldwide attention and was able to do something about it that affects every single plate on this planet.
Right, right.
And I thought, we need more stories where people can empower themselves to do this kind of thing because... it seems so hopeless, frankly, sometimes, that I felt that it would really be worth telling Carrie's story because he pulled it off,
Yeah.
He was able to do it.
He is remarkable. To talk just briefly about that mass crop extinction, why don't you give us an idea of what you're talking about there? Because I don't think most people realize just how much we have winnowed down the cultivated, crops that we use, right. as opposed to what was available originally. And also why would we do that? Like, I mean, I know why, but maybe not everybody else does. What I mean? Like why is that an issue?
So we've been farming for 10,000 years. And during that time, we created a tremendous amount of diversity. I forget, I think there were something like at one time 150 different kinds of celery, you know, and now there are three.
Right.
And that's sort of across the board. We didn't ever have an exact head count of how many we had, but we began to realize in the 50s and 60s when industrial farming really took hold that that no one was growing out certain seeds that the smallholder farmer had saved, had been passed down generation after generation. And we had tremendous diversity in the United States because we had such an immigrant population.
Mm-hmm.
They would bring their seeds over here as the one thing they could carry to sort of, you know, hold their connection to their past. And so when we started buying up these small farms and Big Ag took over, those seeds were no longer planted. And mm-hmm. during that time, we lost somewhere between 93% and 97%
wow.
of all the food variety that we once had.
Right. That's pretty stunning.
It's pretty stunning.
Yeah.
So, you know, people who worked in that field were aware of it, but no one knew quite what to do with it. And so there are seed banks all over the world. We have a national seed bank in the United States, which unfortunately has suffered tremendous cutbacks recently
mm-hmm.
Because politicians generally don't look at the big picture. They look at, you know, what's going to be looking good for them at the end of their term. And
mm-hmm.
seed banks are long-term propositions, and we don't really feel the effects of this kind of thing for years and years, and sometimes until it's too late. So a lot of seed banks have been lost over the years, too. And with that, of course, those important collections. So Carrie had this idea, along with the Swedish government, Norwegian government,
yeah.
To try and find a safe haven for these seeds that would be sustainable, that wouldn't require a huge amount of money, and that would save the seeds in perpetuity, so for generations to come. And they did this with a rather small investment, really, when you consider the impact of $9 million to build this vault in Svalbard, which is one of the coldest places I've ever been to.
Yeah, I really want you to describe what it was like, because Svalbard is above the Arctic Circle.
Yes.
In Norway, and it's, you know, the conditions, climate conditions are really harsh. It's really windy, as I recall.
Yeah. I mean, it can be quite windy, and, of course, wind chill there is a whole other meaning. It was 50 below when
I was there.
And it sounds really strange, but after shooting outside and walking into the vault, which is 30 below, I have to say it felt much warmer to me.
That's amazing.
I know. It is kind of amazing.
And so the seeds are stored in Svalbard because even climate change is not going to have an impact on that particular location? Is that the theory?
No. Climate change will have an impact, a global impact. There's no question about that. But what they did was they selected a place that could be cold enough to preserve the seeds for a long time,
mm-hmm.
even if the generators failed.
Right.
That's a big problem with a lot of the seed vaults in places like Africa, which is where there's some of our greatest diversity, have been lost because generators failed.
Yeah.
It's cold, permanently cold. Also, they built it into the side of a mountain, so it's protected. They also looked at, you know, what would happen if all the ice melted, would the sea rise high enough to cover the vault? They are thinking that they're high enough that they'll be safe. So,
wow.
You know, they took everything they could think of into consideration. Now, whether or not in, in the history of this planet, the seed vault will survive. Who knows? Because hopefully it's going to have a long, very long history.
Probably longer than human.
I think so.
Yeah, I do too.
Going anyway.
Especially the way we're going. Exactly. Tell me, so how many plant species are preserved there? And are people continuing to contribute to that?
It's an ongoing process. The plant species that are there are all agricultural.
Uh-huh.
And almost every major collection, I think, except for the Ethiopian collection, is there.
Oh, wow.
I mean, there's still some smaller collections that they're negotiating for. Even pieces of the collection here in the U.S. Is not totally backed up at Svalbard. I don't know the exact number, and I just heard Carrie quote it at the Botanical Garden the other day. It's in the hundreds of thousands, and I can't remember exactly the number.
Okay, but that gives us an idea. Hundreds of thousands of agricultural crops are preserved in this one area, and they represent many countries around the globe, so that, say, in Africa, you need to repopulate a certain type of seed, you will have something with which to start, even if you end up having to hybridize it with something else in order to account for climate resistance or whatever, you know.
That's right. That's...
How did they coordinate getting so many of the specimens from so many countries? Was it something that, I mean, I know you said that a lot of countries have seed banks, but I'm thinking, like, you know, a lot of countries probably don't, I don't know, maybe they... I don't know. How did they do it? I'm not going to speculate.
Well,
I'm going to ask the question.
I can tell you that much. First, they had to all sign off on an international plant treaty.
Uh-huh.
And one of the things that treaty, International Plant Genetics Treaty, and one of the things that treaty provided for was that in the event... because what used to happen is if a country lost their seeds through some catastrophic event, say a flood, that in order to repatriate them, they would have to go to all the people, all the different people who had those seeds, which could take years.
Right.
Meanwhile, you know, that's a lot of lost.
Meanwhile,
harvest.
Your population is starving. Yeah.
Right. So now, when you sign the International Plant Genetics Treaty, and also the reason why some people haven't signed on, is you have to agree that if there's a catastrophic event, you will repatriate seeds if you're asked to the country that's affected. So that's a protection for those countries.
Yeah.
But there are some countries who, Ethiopia is one that I can think of in particular, that's always, I think, has always been a bit of a sore spot about the fact that coffee started in Ethiopia, and the Ethiopians really haven't been able to capitalize on that crop the way they might have had they sort of kept their property rights, kept their intellectual property rights for that those seeds. So that that was a very tricky issue, and but most countries were willing to sign on for the added protection.
Sure.
And the other thing that people, I think, don't understand about the seed vault is that those collections are essentially backed up in the vault. They're not just existing in the vault. They're also in those places where those collections are held. Those are duplicate copies.
Uh-huh.
So they're now in two places. Like, you know, it's like backing up your computer. You know, you need to have a safe copy. It's just an added layer of protection, and it took, I think, Carrie, almost, I want to say, 30 years.
Whoa! I think I remember that from watching the film.
Mm-hmm.
That it was at least 30 years of interest on his part, you know, and sort of plugging along, trying to make people more aware of the impact of. of both loss of diversity in the plant world and also the impact of climate change, which he was obviously more prescient about than many others. And I wanted to kind of jump ahead to talk about, because one of the things that he brings up in the film is he connects climate change to crop failures and then crop failures to civil strife. And I wondered if you could comment on that, just because the film, you made the film in 2014, I think?
Mm-hmm.
And now it's available on Netflix. That's why you and I are talking, right?
Yes, and iTunes and Amazon Prime.
And Amazon Prime. Mm-hmm. So, because I do remember when the film came out. I don't know why I didn't interview you then. this is totally grist to my mill. I mean, you're absolutely the type of interview I do. And I do a lot of work around animals and diversity of breeds. But
another issue, actually.
Yeah, totally. Absolutely. Oh, I did the most fascinating. I wrote a book about meat right now. Let's talk about me, Sandy. No, but I just finished a manuscript about a book about global, industrialized meat production around the world.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the most interesting aspects I discovered or actually delved into was the genetics and the fact that most of the world's livestock breeds are controlled by four companies. And so there's a lot of parallels between what you guys are trying to fight against and what mm-hmm. the meat world is trying to fight against.
It's the same process.
It's the same process, yeah.
It's the sort of industrialization of those.
Yeah. But when you guys started working on this film, which was completed in 2014, how much? I feel like climate change awareness or climate change acceptance has accelerated just in the last year or year and a half. And I have the feeling like in 2014 when this film came out that there wasn't as much of a sense of urgency around the issue. Would you agree? And
that's
then can you talk a little bit about the civil strife part of
it? No, in fact, when I was making the film, I sort of made the decision that I had heard enough at that point myself that I believed that climate change was a kind of no-brainer.
Yeah.
And I refused to deal in the film with whether or not it was a real issue. I just took it as a real issue, as did Carrie, as do most people who understand agriculture, I think.
Right.
The State Department included. And realized, you know, how civilizations rise and fall on their ability to meet the needs of the food needs of their populations.
Uh-huh.
And you know, a lot of people now are seeing, what's happening in the Middle East as being prompted by that, which was that connection made early on. So it's a very real threat, and the more we winnow down our water resources and our soil erosion and all these things, all these sort of assaults that, that as Carrie says in the film, can create a perfect storm
mm-hmm.
or this kind of scenario, the more at risk we are. And you know, I hate to put the finger on one thing, but one of the main things that I see it really is industrial ag. You know,
oh yeah,
we took the small farmer out of the equation. We lost our connection to food. You know, that was around TV dinner time and all that sort
yep.
of thing. And in losing that connection, we lost a big part of, I think, what should be actually sort of sacred to us, you know,
mm-hmm.
And we need it back, not just for our bellies, but also for our souls, I think. So it's something that, when I really understood the big picture, I thought, you know, I really wanted to spend time and see if I could get the story right, because it would, in that story, there's so much contained in that one story.
Yes, I agree. Absolutely. I wanted to also address, you had some really nice, a long time ago, Jack, you remember when I interviewed that guy, Peter Pringle, and he wrote a book called The Murder of Nikolai Vavilov.
Yep.
Did you read that, Sandy?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So I interviewed him right after that book came out. It was one of the first shows I did for the network. So it's easily 6-7 years ago. And you had a lot of really interesting footage from the Vavilov Institute, which I thought, because he died in disgrace in jail, I thought that they had just basically discarded the results of all of his labor. But instead, they didn't. So can you tell us a little bit about him? Because he was sure. such an interesting character.
Well, he was really one of the first people to realize the what the impact of industrial farming was going to be. And this is like it. We're talking the 20s and 30s.
Yeah.
And he began to travel around the world and start to collect this diversity and had the greatest collection of diversity in the world in St. Petersburg, Russia.
Right.
Unfortunately, he was on the wrong side of the line for Lenin, and because he was a world figure and part of the bourgeoisie, he was imprisoned, and ironically enough, for a man who probably has done as much to feed the world as anyone, starved to death in prison. But, you know, that collection was held high because after the war, they needed those seeds to start feeding what was already a starving population. So the collection for a long time was very highly prized and very carefully kept. But when I was there, I guess it was 2013, the collection was not only in pretty bad shape, they were starting to sell off parts of the fields where they grow out the seeds to developers.
Oh, wow. No kidding.
Because the land, which had been set aside during Vavilov's time, was becoming so valuable that these developers wanted to put condominiums and so forth on it.
Oh.
And the Russian government under Putin doesn't really value this collection as much as they value the real estate. So now not only have they lost a lot of those fields, they are probably going to lose that place that I shot in. When I was there, all the people who worked there could not make a living by working there. They had to have other jobs.
Oh, no way, really?
Yeah, the collection was not funded enough to support their services, really. So
incredible.
Their lifestyle. So so these guys were really heroes to be doing this for the Russian people. But I understand since then that there was interest in the building that the Vavilov Center is in, and that they may actually lose that building, and therefore probably the collection will be lost too.
Well, it looked from the film like the seed collection is certainly not being preserved in any sort of cryovac'd cold storage.
I mean,
it was like you showed footage of like these old folders of dried up, you know, stems and leaves and seeds, and you know, it was very archaic looking.
Well, yeah, and they have some cryo preservation there, which was not always functional. The real tragedy is a lot of those seeds are not grown in any farmer's field. So
yeah,
that diversity will be lost along with that collection. And although they have backed up some of it with Svalbard, not nearly all of it. I forget. I think Carrie says in the film, is it like a third of the collection maybe has been backed up there?
Something like that, yeah. But I found that book incredibly moving. I loved it. And I really didn't know anything because I just started doing this show and I really didn't know anything about agriculture or seed banking. I knew about the Seed Savers Exchange, which we're going to talk about in a second. But I found that whole story so extraordinary because it was two different theories of agriculture competing. And, you know, the other guy won, and that's how it turned out that Vavilov wound up in prison, as I recall. But he didn't just stay in the Soviet Union or what was the Soviet Union. I mean, he traveled really all over Western Europe and North Africa, didn't he? And collected
the United States.
He collected seeds from all over the world. Mm-hmm. And
he saved seeds, actually, that eventually were repatriated to us.
Oh, is that right? Wow.
Mm-hmm.
Fascinating. It was such a great story. It was a wonderful book. I wish it had gotten more attention. But, you know, anyway, maybe it will now after this. Tell us a little bit about what, like, the big animal, just to jump back to the big animal genetics companies that I talked about a few minutes ago. A lot of them are recognizing the value of heritage breeds. And there's a company in Holland called Hendrix, which is one of the four big companies. And they specialize in chickens, layers and broilers, but especially layers. And they have actually started their own heritage breed seed bank, as it were. And do you think that Monsanto or Syngenta or DuPont are doing the same thing? Are they collecting seeds to work with their, you know, genetically modified organisms? I mean,
well, they need the genetic diversity, just like everyone else does, so that they can put together the seeds with the proper whatever it is, drought resistance or heat tolerance or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm sure they do. I don't know that much about them, but they certainly have the resources to do that.
Yeah, I mean, I would think they would be very active in this field. It's sort of interesting to me that they're not. I mean, I think that agricultural universities, you know, land extension schools and all of that stuff have been highly corrupted by big agricultural interests.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's why a lot of this kind of sort of almost, you want to call it almost folklore or, you know, heritage information, historical information about crops, is not being successfully sold to students or even being studied, you know, significantly.
Well, most of the universities now are funded by those companies.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, if you're a scientist and you want a grant, you're not going to get a grant from a national, you know, from a public federally funded grant organization.
Right.
You're going to get it from Monsanto.
And if you want to be a plant breeder, and the world is woefully low on plant breeders.
Is that right, like, Sandy? I didn't know that.
There's only, I forget the number, but it's like 6 plant breeders who deal with a banana.
Right.
You know, that's the world supply of bananas. There probably are very few who work with sorghum or, you know, some of the crops that are so important in developing countries.
Mm-hmm.
So plant breeders, I mean, if there are any younger people out there who are interested in this area at all, the world is woefully short on plant breeders and people who can help us develop the new varieties that we're going to need in the future to deal with some of the things that are happening.
Yeah, absolutely. Let's talk for a minute, because we're going to have to wrap this up in a couple minutes. Let's talk a little bit about, we didn't mention the Iowa Seed Savers Exchange. Now, that's something that people can be involved in on a micro level.
Mm-hmm.
And that's an organization that started out in Iowa, but actually I think all 50 states participate, don't they?
They have a huge catalog of people that they work with that
mm-hmm.
Help them save seeds and bring new seeds into the fold from all over the place. And in the film, there's one example of their annual Seed Savers Exchange event where people come together and share seeds. And, you know, what they're really sharing is a great tomato or the best watermelon you ever had or an onion that you've never tasted. Which is really exciting and tasty. And unfortunately, when I went there, it seemed to me that most of those people were over the age of 40.
It looked that way to me.
Yeah, so I'm hoping that, you know, I it seems to me more and more I hear about younger people getting interested in food and farming and
I think that's happening. But, I mean, as we both know, and as many of the listeners right now know, the median age of a farmer in the United States is like 53. I mean, it's come down from 57. That's a good thing.
Well, I learned, I was at a conference in San Francisco last week, an amazing conference called The True Cost of American Food.
Oh, I wish I could have gone to that. Yeah, I read about that.
Fascinating.
Yeah,
and and some really interesting people there. But one of the things, oh, I just forgot what I was going to say, Kathy. One of the things,
Katie.
Katie.
Yeah.
One of the things that they were talking about was that in Iowa, 55% of the land is owned by farmers over 75 years old.
Wow.
So how about that?
But a lot of the land in Iowa is now owned by very large agricultural concerns because they're such
Well,
right?
And the scary thing is probably that 55% land, when it comes up for sale, will also be, there's a possibility it'll also be grabbed by big ag.
Oh, yeah.
But wouldn't it be great if we could start to get it back to smallholder farmers and figure out a way to make that work again?
Yeah, I mean, there should be a way. There should be sort of almost a homesteading movement. I mean, for, you know, for farmers who want to, you know, get out of the business but don't want to see their land taken by large agricultural concerns. You know, set up some sort of government funding where you get a loan from the government to start your farm, and you have 10 years to pay it off, and then you own the land. Something
right.
like that. Remember, I mean, the Homestead Act was great. That was a big deal. Really helped this country. So what are we doing with the film? We're going to promote the film right now. Tell me about it. People can see it on Netflix. It's called Seeds of Time. There's a
That's
website.
Right.
What's
it's
your Twitter
Amazon
handle?
Amazon Prime and iTunes. And we actually just showed it at the New York Botanical Gardens on Earth Day.
Oh, good.
It's a really good film for anyone who's interested in the foundation of agriculture, and sort of a story about one person who was able to do a lot to help help make sure that there's going to be some diversity on our plates.
Right, but also I think on the bigger scale, I also felt like what it was also to create an understanding around how agriculture has changed and what we are losing and why we need to maintain crop diversity, plant diversity, in order to manage the impacts of climate change going forward. And that was the big takeaway message. And also the fact that climate change is not something that we speculate on anymore. It's here, it's happening. And when you talk to farmers around the world, really, they're all going to tell you the same thing. Yes, it's hotter, or yes, we get more rain than we used to, or we don't get enough rain, or, you know, however it works for them in their microclimate.
Right. I mean, in the film, we use the example of these Peruvian farmers.
That's right. I meant to talk about them, and I got sidetracked. But that was a very interesting part of the film, actually. And they said, I wanted to clarify something now that we're still talking. No, but they mentioned something, and I wasn't sure I completely understood this, about how they had used a quote-unquote improved potato, which had ultimately failed for them, and then they had to go back to, you know, sort of reviving these older heirloom varietals. Can you just, you know, quickly unpack that? Because that was quite interesting. So you're saying that in the film, you were saying that they used, like, say, an industrial potato.
They used essentially the potatoes that we eat.
Uh-huh.
Peru is the is the origin of the potatoes.
Right.
The greatest diversity of potato grows in Peru. And these farmers have now access to 1,800 varieties of potato and grow them out. But before that, during the war, during the Shining Path, these guys in the Sacred Valley lost their land. And they lost their crops. And so when they finally started trying to get their land and put their lives back together again, they were given potatoes from some American companies, like the kind we eat, which were very detrimental to them because they didn't hold up well in the climate, and they weren't nutritious enough.
Uh-huh.
These are people who eat almost only potatoes for their diet. And while I was there, I ate potatoes, and it's amazing the different kinds of nutrition they can get by different types of soil and different altitudes that they grow these potatoes in. And
fascinating.
Different varietals.
See, I would do very well in Peru because potato is one of my favorite foods.
Well, you would love potatoes.
I would love it. Yes, I would. Sounds great. Anyway, Sandy, we have to wrap it up there, but thank you so much for joining me today. And do you live in New York?
I do.
Oh, well, perhaps we will cross paths at some point.
That would be nice.
Thank you very much for joining me today. And, you know, the film is lovely and wonderful, and people should see it. It's on Netflix. It's on iTunes. It is on Amazon Prime. And I highly recommend it, Seeds of Time. Thank you very much, Sandy McLeod.
Thank you.
And thank you to my sponsor, Bonnie Plants. I remembered. And thanks, as always, to Jack Inslee, my engineer. See you next week, folks. Thanks for listening.
Thanks for listening to this program on heritageradionetwork.org. You can find all of our archived programs on our website or as podcasts in the iTunes store by searching Heritage Radio Network. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can email us questions at any time at info@heritageradionetwork.org. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization. To donate and become a member, visit our website today. Thanks for listening.
Hey, listeners, we're nearing the end of our 15th anniversary fundraising campaign, and we need your help to meet our goal. This campaign offers you a chance to win a unique food and music experience in one of the most exciting cities in America. Here's how it works. Donate to HRN and you'll be entered to win dinner for two and two tickets to a concert in one of eight amazing cities: New York, Los Angeles, Philadelphia, Nashville, Las Vegas, Charleston, Ardmore, Pennsylvania, and Asheville. All donations support our work educating food system storytellers. And when you donate, you can choose one of those cities and you'll be entered to win dinner and two tickets to a show. So help us reach our goal and enter to win dinner and a show in the city of your choice. Check out heritageradionetwork.org/15 to donate and enter to win today. That's heritageradionetwork.org/15. Thank you.